So as a speaker, it's very difficult to come to DEF CON and watch really terrific talks and not develop some sense of speaker envy, you know? So this is a very humbling thing to do. And even though this is my sixth year doing this, it's nothing I take lightly, and it's a great honor to be in front of you guys doing this. So I'd just like to thank the goons that do Speaker Ops and Nikita for making this a really great experience as a speaker. So every year at DEF CON, something new happens, and I had a new experience this year. I was at Black Hat. Oh, I want to thank the people that came to my book signing at Black Hat as well. I was at Black Hat. It was all done there, and decided to come here to the Rio on Thursday, pick up my credentials. And I went home. I live here in Vegas. And I very innocently took out my materials, and I sat down my Black Hat badge on my dining room table. And then I put my DEF CON badge next to it. And I looked at it, and I go, well, this is really interesting. And I did a tweet, you know, the difference between Black Hat and DEF CON in one picture. And I thought it was amusing, but I didn't think it was, you know, that amusing. Well, between retweets and favorites and whatnot, this got reposted like 700 times on Twitter. So my phone was doing this for almost the entire con. It was like warm. So that was a cool experience. It was a very cool experience. So my name is Michael Schrenk. I'm the author of WebBot Spiders and Screen Scrapers. I'll be doing a book signing right after this talk at the No Starch booth. So if you have questions, that'd be a good place to hook up. I don't tell people that I write botnets and bots anymore. That's what I do, and I've been doing it for like 20 years. I don't tell people that I do that anymore because I'm either met with blank stares or looks of horror. So now I just tell people I do business intelligence, and that seems to have a better story for people. I've been doing DEF CON since 97. DEF CON 5 was my first one. And I came out here to cover it for Computer World magazine. It was the first article that I had ever had published. And I started thinking this weekend about the effect DEF CON has had on my life. If I hadn't come out here for that, I would have never been published. I would have never got a book deal. All the things that came after the book, all the foreign travel, the speaking opportunities, the gigs that I probably didn't deserve. You know, if DEF CON hadn't made me come out to Vegas once a year for 17 years, I probably never would have moved here. You know, it's an awesome thing. It's a very awesome thing. So today, what I'm going to talk about, the name of the talk is You're Leaking Trade Secrets. But what I'm really talking about is organizational privacy. And it's a little bit different than personal privacy, because individuals tend to leak identity kind of issues, whereas organizations tend to leak trade secrets. So the message I want you to have coming out of here is that information that you put online, on the web, is not always read by the intended audience, and it's not always used the way it's intended to be used. Now, there's been a lot of awareness for personal privacy, but there's been much less awareness of organizational privacy, and I think that's largely because of the way the media handles it. The media's been really good informing people about things, but less good informing organizations. And I think a lot of that is the types of stories they cover. So in the case of leaked trade secrets, these kinds of stories are always treated as news stories. You know, they're factual, but they don't really teach any lessons. Whereas, you know, there are other reasons, I think, for the press covering personal privacy issues. For example, for one thing, it creates a lot of customers for a lot of advertisers. So it makes good business sense to do that kind of thing. The other kind of thing is that just really good content. You know, one of my favorite stories about a personal leak, about a year ago, there was a headmaster at a private school, I believe it's in Georgia, who was let go. And he felt he was let go for the wrong reasons. He felt it was age discrimination. So he filed a suit. They settled out of court. with the stipulation that he never talked about the case. Okay? So what does his daughter do? She gets on Facebook. She was also a student at the school, by the way. And she let everybody know that the case was settled and her school was paying for her summer trip to Europe. So it's great content. It's great content. The other story I really like, too, is that if you're a soldier and if you are stationed someplace where your government says you're not, you should probably remove the geocodes off your selfie before you upload it to Instagram. Yeah, I love that one. But you know, these are great because they teach lessons. And the lesson that this should be teaching all of us is that there is not a piece of software, there's not a piece of hardware that can protect against this kind of stuff. It's an awareness thing, and there's really no substitute for awareness. Okay, so one of the things I'm going to do here, we're talking about trade secrets. We should define what a trade secret is. I've got some examples of unintentional data leaks. And this is really all about business intelligence, because if there wasn't somebody doing things with these leaks, they really wouldn't matter, right? So we're going to look a little bit about how online intelligence is different than offline intelligence. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about what can be done to minimize the effects of all this kind of stuff. So what is a trade secret? Trade secrets are intellectual property, but they're very different than patents, and they're very different than copyrights. The biggest difference is that you don't need to publish a trade secret. And obviously, if you did publish one, it would no longer be a trade secret, right? So that's kind of obvious. Unlike patents and unlike copyrights, they have absolutely no expiration date. And they're protected by something called the UTSA. And this came about, I believe, 70s or 80s. And it was required because unlike patents and unlike copyrights, there was no federal laws covering trade secrets. So they pulled together a bunch of things. And I think all but one or two states now have signed off on this. But it used to be an issue because if you were a big company and you had offices across the country, you would be subject to the various trade secret laws in those various states. So this simplified things quite a bit. In order to be a trade secret, it must have some kind of economic value. The interesting thing that I think about trade secrets is that you can use anybody's trade secret if you happen to discover it on your own. So if you find it on a piece of paper on a sidewalk, you can use it. If you find it in WikiLeaks, you can use it. If you discover it through reverse engineering, you can use it if you discover it. So what is the value of a trade secret? Well, basically, one other thing I think I forgot to mention is you have to make some effort to protect it. That's the other thing. You can't just come back retroactively and say, hey, that's a trade secret. That doesn't work. The reason you establish trade secrets basically is so you can sue people. And you can recover losses, you can recover damages, you can recover attorney's fees, that kind of stuff. But only if somebody misappropriates your trade secret. If you lose it through your own stupidity, it's your own fault. So when people think about trade secrets, they automatically think about things like the recipe for Coca-Cola, or the formula for a fragrance like Chanel No. 5. The interesting thing about fragrances is that you can't copyright or patent a fragrance, but you can have a trade secret over the formula. So if you go into Walgreens or someplace and find all these knockoff fragrances, they're perfectly legal because you can't copyright or patent or somehow protect a fragrance. But you can trade secret the process or the recipe. A lot of times, trade secrets are used in conjunction with patents. So you might have some patents, but the way you implement those patents is some kind of a process that's protected by trade secrets. But today, more often, trade secrets take the form of data. And I just listed a few of these here. You know, things like your list of your employees, your list of your suppliers, customer lists, funding sources, expansion plans, marketing plans, new product planning, pricing strategy, supplier issues, labor issues, how quickly things move in and out of your inventory, how fast things sell, IT infrastructure changes, security information. This is all data, and these are all trade secrets. And in your organization, you should treat these as secrets. And every list, or every industry is going to have a different list. You know, depending on what you're doing, and you're going to have different things that you're going to call trade secrets. For example, in the European Union, they have much more progressive privacy laws than we have here in the States. And in the EU, if somebody is collecting personal data, you have a right to go to that organization and say, what is the data that you're collecting on me? And they have to show it to you. Well, somebody in, I believe, Ireland approached Facebook and says, I want all my data. I want to know what you're collecting on me. Well, Facebook used a little exemption in the law that said, if through the disclosure you're going to show trade secrets, you're exempt from the law. And Facebook said, hey, that's us. That's us. And these are all the trade secrets that Facebook wanted to protect. And I'm not putting these up here for you to read them. I'm just showing you there were 22 of them. There were a lot of them. And they included things like, if you delete an image, we just erase the pointer. It's still really there. If you poke somebody, we record that, all that kind of stuff. And they were saying, if you have our data, you're essentially learning about what we do with that data simply by the nature of that data. So data has become a trade secret. So you've got all these potential trade secrets now, and they're all floating around on the internet, and this has really changed the way business intelligence is collected. For example, before 1995, and I use 1995 because for me that's kind of when the internet matured, I think, a little bit. Before 1995, all the web pages looked like NASA web pages, and things had just matured a little bit then. So before 1995, you had to do things like this guy. This is Mitch Modell. He is the CEO of Modell Sporting Goods. And he was accused of the following. He dressed up in a disguise, misrepresented himself at his major competitor, Dick's Sporting Goods, went into one of their corporate offices, told the receptionist that he was a executive for Dick's, and he was waiting for a meeting with the CEO, and she proceeded to show him a room where there were a lot of files, where he started going through files and taking pictures and notes and whatnot. He was basically just helping himself to information. What makes this story really weird is that the same guy, Mitch Modell, was also on Undercover Boss on CBS, where he basically did the same thing except for his own employees. So he was really into this. But this is the way intelligence was often gathered prior to the internet. So before 1995, there were a limited number of sources. Where are you going to go? You go look at the patent files, you look at the newspaper, maybe you subscribe to a clipping service. Business intelligence was really time consuming because it was so manual, so that made it a really expensive process. So it's not something you could do over and over again. You basically would take a snapshot of what was happening at a certain time. It often required physical contact. Maybe you would go to a conference and you'd get your competitor drunk and you'd talk to him and not tell him who you were. We've probably all done that. So it required physical content, and it often required people to identify themselves, or if not identify themselves, occasionally get caught. So your anonymity would be blown. So now after 95, man, there's almost an unlimited number of, well, I would say there is an unlimited number of sources because they keep coming in and out. We can automate data collection. We can repeat it, do it day after day. You start looking at data collected over time. You can start to analyze trends and do all kinds of cool stuff. It can be done remotely, and it can usually be done anonymously. So you see here, this looks a lot like hacking, right? You can do it remotely, you can automate it, you can do it anonymously. So basically, business intelligence has now become a form of hacking, as far as I'm concerned. The other thing about business intelligence collected online is that it is immediately actionable. And this was evident in my talk last year where I talked about a botnet that I wrote that purchased probably around $20 million worth of cars over a period of about 9 months, $20 million retail. It did it totally by itself. And we also defeated some Russian hackers too, by the way. But this data that we had, basically the inside information we had is we had some inside information on server characteristics that allowed a client to basically buy things at will. And we were able to act on that intelligence immediately. So through the eyes of a hacker, anything you put online is potential business intelligence. And that's a really important point. Again, every industry has its own cases. I picked out a few that I think we can all relate to. All right, so imagine the plight of an online retailer. So this is what they're thinking. I need to keep my online store up to date, and I need to keep up with what's happening with competitors as far as pricing. So I need to respond to my market, basically. So a hacker looks at that and says, hey, I can watch the store remotely, I can do it anonymously, and I can automate the information gathering. So if you monitor a retail site and do it over time, it's possible to leak your pricing strategies. You can start to figure things out. You can figure out inventory strategies. You know, you have items coming and going. Why is that? Why is this no longer offered? Sometimes it can show supplier issues. Like if it's something you know that they always have, but they don't have it now and they really should have it, they're having a supplier issue. If they come off and they're always consistently at a lower price than you and they appear to still be making a profit, they're probably buying it from somebody other than you are, or they've got a better deal than what you have. The problem is much greater when you are a retailer and you're selling specific items, okay? So we're not talking Sears here now that's got an infinite number of t-shirts. We're talking about a real estate website that has one house on the corner of 3rd and Main, okay? We're talking about Estee Crafter. Estee, by the way, is a huge business. It's in excess of $1 billion a year. eBay merchants tend to sell one item at a time. So you can learn a lot about what's a good thing to sell on eBay just by looking at top sellers and watching what sells and for what price. Used bookstores tend to sell single copies of things, third-party Amazon retailers, car dealerships with VINs and SKUs, any kind of seller of collectibles. This group includes anyone selling any kind of uniquely identifiable goods. So if you watch one of these stores over time, they basically disclose their entire sales records, right? You monitor this long enough, you pretty much have enough information where you could do their accounting for them. And this is something people don't think about. Okay, let's look at, I love picking on HR because I think they're probably the biggest source of leaks within organizations. So let's think about an HR manager. Put yourself in their position. They're thinking, this year, it's going to be a busy year for us. We got a lot of stuff going on. I need to post 250 job postings this year. So that's what they're thinking. That's what they're tasked with. The hacker, on the other hand, thinks, I can watch these job postings remotely, and I can be anonymous while I'm doing it. I can even look like somebody else. I could look like an actual job seeker if I wanted to. And I can automate the information gathering attack. So what does this do? Well, let's just look at a simple job listing here. This is an actual listing. I won't tell you the company it came from. This is a decent job listing. I'll show you one later that's not so decent, but this one's fine. Doesn't seem to be anything wrong with it, except, whoa, we have a new location here. We haven't seen this before. And, oh, we have a new skill. That's something we haven't seen before. Well, if you look at this over time, you know, you're watching these remotely, you're being anonymous, you're automating the information gathering, you can start to graph things. You can check out when new postings go out. You can see when new skills are mentioned. You can look at when new locations are mentioned and say, oh yeah, here's a, they've never hired an HR contract representative before. I wonder what's going on there. And Portuguese, they haven't needed that before. And an office in Puerto Rico, what's going on here? So if you look at stuff, and if you look at how the listings come and go, it starts to paint a narrative where you can start figuring out a company's strategic plans, okay? I've been in a lot of HR meetings. I've never heard anyone say, are we leaking our strategic plans by listing these jobs? You know, I've never heard anybody say that. Let's look at another one. I love this example. I'm going to advertise a vacancy we have for an IT help desk professional. Okay, that sounds like a nice thing to do, right? Well, a hacker comes along and says, well, can I read between the lines to learn how to compromise your network? Well, let's take a look. So this is a recreation of an actual ad. And this was an actual ad from a law firm that I used to deal with. And I saw this published, I got on the phone, talked to one of my friends who was a partner over there and said, you need to take this ad down now. And so you look at it, it looks fine. You know, it's a law firm and the company overview, little job description. We have an immediate opening for IT help desk professional with mastery of Windows networking and remote access tools like PC Anywhere and phone dial-in systems. This was a few years ago. Talks about the responsibilities. So yeah, I mean, it looks like a nice little opportunity for somebody. And it's like, whoa, what's this? They're announcing they have secrets. They're a law firm. Do they have to announce they're a law firm? No. No, the IT people you hire for law firms are essentially the same IT people you would hire for any kind of manufacturing plant or what have you, right? It's like, oh, they have secrets. We know they have secrets because they're a law firm. We know what kind of secrets they have. They do acquisitions. So if you deal in stocks at all, this might be interesting information, right? I wonder whose secrets they have. Oh, they've got their client list. So we know they've got secrets. We know what kind of secrets they have. We know whose secrets they are. Okay, let's look a little bit further here. Never say you have an immediate opening for an IT position like this, because that means there's nobody there now. No one's watching the store. What kind of social engineering could happen with nobody watching the store, you know? Oh, they're telling us how to break into their network. They're using PC Anywhere and phone dial-in systems. So you guys remember how this worked back in the day. You just start at the bottom of a block of numbers and start dialing until you get something that sounds like a fax machine, you know? And then you just start, there's nobody watching the store. Get your passwords ready. All right, because we can automate attacks, right? The other thing is that they're leaking the fact that they have problems during remote access. Okay, so social engineering-wise, I mean, yeah. You know, and the other thing is, this was the only IT ad they had advertised, and this guy's got way too many responsibilities. Helping attorneys, you know, working remotely, responsible for network security, software install, license management, policy development, probably has to do some training along the way, right? This guy's overwhelmed, so what could possibly go wrong? What kind of social engineering scenarios can you think of? You know, what I would do is I would call them up and ask them, they'll tell me if this job's been filled, right? Just ask HR. Oh yeah, we filled that. Great. You wait for the guy to get settled a little bit. You pose as one of these attorneys who's remote. You're having problems dialing in. It's 2:00 in the afternoon. You've got a surprise hearing at 2:15. You want to settle things out of court. You need a paper from the home office so bad. This guy is new. He's going to do everything possible to help you out. You're in. So be careful what you put in ads, especially IT ads.
All right. What was your response to that when you told them?
You ever go fishing? Take a hook out of a fish's mouth? That's kind of the response. It's like, what? Really? Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. They did take the ad down. Okay. So basically what we talked about so far is watching websites and building a database over time of changes and whatnot. Sometimes databases are left in plain sight. And that was what happened here. This, if you follow elections at all, this was one to watch because it was so bizarre. It was the senatorial election of 2006 in the state of Minnesota. It was an extraordinarily close election. It was decided by a few votes after a long period in the court systems. There was a lot of shenanigans going back and forth, a lot of accusations of hacking, a lot of servers going down, a lot of weird things happening. But probably the strangest part about this election was the cast of characters involved. I mean, we started off with Al Franken, who is today the junior senator from the state of Minnesota, but probably better known for his days on Saturday Night Live, where he was a writer and a cast member for, I think, over 10 years, a long time. Norm Coleman has a really interesting political background. He started off as, well, his first elected office, he was elected mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota. He changed party affiliations and was reelected as mayor of St. Paul. He later ran for governor of Minnesota, where he was defeated by this guy, Jesse Ventura. He was the incumbent in this race, and he became the incumbent largely because his opponent died in a plane crash 2 weeks before his election. If you remember the crash, Paul Wellstone back in 2006. And then there was a third party candidate who did pretty well. He got 500,000 votes, Dean Barkley. And he was most well known for being the political advisor for this guy, Jesse Ventura. So it was a lively, it was a very lively election. I believe Ventura was actually the governor during this period. So what happened is after the election, day after the election, Norm Coleman claimed victory. He had the most votes, not enough to keep the mandated recount from happening. So it went into a recount. After the recount, Al Franken was ahead by about 300 votes. 6 months later, they decided whether or not they were going to count all the absentee ballots. They counted all those, and Al Franken ended up winning by 312 votes. He actually picked up a few. But there, like I said, there were all kinds of charges of misappropriation of trade secrets. And in such a close election, any little dirt you have on your opponent or anything is gold. Well, along the way, somebody came up with a database of Norm Coleman's political contributors. He had their names, the amount they contributed, where they lived, what they did for a living, their social security numbers. Oh, excuse me, their credit card numbers. And, you know, the first thing, well, we've been hacked. Somebody took our database. Well, no, they didn't. They actually put it... They compressed it and put it up in an unprotected directory on their website. If you ever want to hear the story behind this, Adria Richards has a lot of stuff on YouTube about this. She's the one that discovered this. But basically, they just left it there. And there's a lot of this going on. I don't know if you... There's tons of this. One of the things I do in addition to business intelligence, I do a lot of work with data journalists, and I teach workshops primarily in the UK and in the Netherlands and Belgium and through there. And I love working with investigative journalists because they've got a hacker's mind. They think like hackers. You give them a tool, they run with it. They take all their background and experience, and they do all kinds of wonderful things. And I had them doing all kinds of stuff like this. They were finding stockbrokers' lists of clients and how much their funds were and where they had their stuff distributed. And they were basically just doing Google hacking. That's all they were doing. They were just looking for files. And it's amazing what's out there. Oh, one other backstory to this one that I think is kind of interesting. So I somehow came across this database, and it was just an Excel spreadsheet. First thing I did is I imported it into an actual database where I was able to do queries on it. And I was doing queries on it for a couple days, trying to find out interesting combinations of data. And I had done this before. I mean, I had worked with a lot of European newspapers and stuff on doing just this kind of stuff, mostly from Freedom of Information Act kind of stuff. And I had enough information I thought probably would have been good for probably 3 to 5 stories. So I contacted the major newspaper in Minneapolis. I talked to their political editor. told them what I had done, told them the kind of stories that they could generate from this, and the response I got from him was, we have our own IT department. We really don't need what you have. So, okay. All right, cool. Okay, DNS can be a major source of leaks, and especially when it comes to marketing. You know, some of you are probably aware of this, but I've got a couple of examples I think are pretty cool. So you're a marketing person. You go, I need to register some domain name names for new products we have. Well, the hacker comes along and says, hey, I can watch DNS registrations remotely. I can do it anonymously. And more importantly, I can automate the process. Or if I have $750, I can just buy this information. It's a little bit cheaper. It's true. Here we can see that Apple has registered about 4,500 domain names, and for not a lot of money, you can go see what they all are. Do you think Samsung does this? Oh, I'm sure they've got a copy of it, you know? The thing that I found interesting for this is this particular screenshot I took, I was doing a organizational privacy talk in Dublin, Ireland for the Secure Computing Forum. So this snapshot was done in March. They had 4,544 domains on March 17th. I did this again earlier, just last week, and they had almost another 1,000 domains they had checked out. You think there's any intelligence you could gather from those 1,000 domains? I bet there is. Like I said, I bet Samsung has that list.
Unless they're seeding phony domain names as well.
They could be doing that. They could be diversions. But there's probably intelligence you could gather from that as well. The question was, you know, maybe they're not real domain names. But yeah, I think you could probably read between the lines there too. So here's another example. This was an example from a data journalism class I taught through the Center for Investigative Journalism and City College in London. Keep in mind, this is a group of primarily journalists from the UK. They were not Americans. And I asked them, you know, knowing what you know, can you tell me when Sarah Palin gave first real thoughts, first documented thoughts about running for president? So they were all busy. These, again, investigative journalists, they're like hackers. And they started looking at DNS records. I didn't tell them to go to DNS records. They just went there. And they found this listing by Jay Griffin, who after a quick Google search you can find out was her political advisor. And he took out the domains Palin for president, Palin 2012, right? That gives you a little bit of an idea of what they were planning. Sarah Palin 2012. They were all registered on August 24th of 2007. That was pretty much a year before she was interviewed by John McCain, and before this ever became, before she was ever even a candidate for vice president. So there was some talk in the past. So DNS records are like a snapshot of the past. They're like little time capsules. All right. Employees leak trade secrets all the time. You know, they'll do it on a personal level. You multiply that by the number of employees you have. That's the kind of problems that organizations have. So if you're an HR director, again, we're picking on HR, they're going to say, you know, this company is only as great as its employees, and to succeed, I need to train, hire, and retain the very best ones. I need to invest some money in them. And because of that, your list of employees is really a trade secret. So what does a hacker think? Well, the hacker thinks LinkedIn and Twitter. That's what they think. Because you can go onto LinkedIn, and within a matter of minutes, I could probably tell you every new business development person in your company. And if I triangulate that information with their endorsements and what they're doing on Twitter, I could tell you who your client list is. Okay, that's not information you want to have out. Sometimes, you can't keep people from using social media, but you can keep them from doing really stupid things. For example, this is a case where, and this is actually pretty common, people leaking the code names of top secret NSA projects on their LinkedIn profile. you know, as far as, yeah, this is my experience. I worked on this project. And, you know, it's a lot easier to find out things about projects if you know what they're called, right? And I actually, this is not just a snapshot in time. This is still going on. So you can't keep people from doing stupid things. Or excuse me, you can't keep people from doing stupid things, but you can monitor, you can keep an eye on things. So what I recommend people doing is use corporate social media accounts for any kind of marketing kind of things you've got going on. And in fact, social media accounts are now actually being considered as intellectual property, just the account itself. There was a case about a year ago where there was a salesperson who was using their Twitter account very effectively. They were marketing through their Twitter account. Their followers on their Twitter account were their customer base. And the name of the Twitter account was something like Bob at ABC Company. Well, Bob at ABC Company jumped ship, took a job with XYZ Company. What does he do? He renames his Twitter handle Bob at XYZ Company. Takes all of his contacts with him. His former employee sues him. It goes into the courts. They won. And they determined that, no, that is not yours. That belongs to your company. So to avoid any kind of thing like that, use official accounts that you have control over if you're going to use social media for marketing. Now, a lot of leaks you really can't avoid. A lot of them are done for the sake of transparency. They're done for regulatory purposes. You know, like if and it's actually worth watching these things. You know, watch court records, see when people are pulling building permits. There's a lot of information you can glean by looking at things like, you know, licensing and you know, FCT filings, that kind of stuff. You should also be aware that your competition has the same issues. So, to the degree that these are problems for yourself, they're also opportunities for learning out more about your competitors. And what I ask everybody to do is to think about what happens if your website is monitored and if all the changes end up in a database someplace. Would that change what you put on your website? I think it probably would. I strongly suggest, especially if you're doing new product stuff and you're taking out domains for new products, use a proxy. Don't do what Apple appears to be doing. Don't host your own website on your own network. There was a case here in Las Vegas within the last year where I believe it was a group associated with Anonymous got into the Sands Corporation. And Sands, if you don't live here in Vegas, they're the people that own the Venetian and the Palazzo. And in addition to breaking into their website, they discovered that the website was on their corporate network. So that gave them access to all kinds of HR records, which they published. And strangely enough, it also gave them access to the network where all the slot machines were. Yeah. So there is no reason to host your own website on your network. In fact, I don't think you should host your own website anywhere. You should have an agency do that for you. There's no reason to do it. The most important thing to do, I think, is to get everybody's buy-in that organizational privacy is important to everybody in the organization. You know, any one leak basically pulls everybody down. So you need to get everybody's buy-in. And again, this is a training issue is what it really is. You need enforceable policies. I mean, how many times have you seen security policies that aren't enforceable? You know, they're as good as not having, and they're worse than not having policies because they give you a good feeling, you know? And when I mean enforceable, they should be enforceable through tools. There should be tools that are enforcing this. You shouldn't need people to do it, you know? In other words, you should be doing your own business intelligence on your own system. Audit everything that you publish. Anything that goes on in your website should be audited through some group. Hopefully that group isn't marketing because they're not going to get it, okay? Because the real important thing here is that security and privacy are not IT functions. They're everybody's responsibility. IT can't protect you from the nonsense that I showed you here. Don't disclose a lot of organizational information on every job posting. It's not even important in most cases that you even put the name of your company on a job posting. You know, there's really no reason to have job listings on your own corporate website. There isn't. I encourage people to use cookies to track their competitors when they're coming to their website. And it's good to do cookies, so you start to associate cookies with IP addresses that you know of known gateways of your competitors. So that way, if you've got their cookies, you can even, you know, if they're using a laptop or a mobile device, if they go someplace else, if they go home and go to your website. Sometimes people will go to your corporate website and look at different things at home than they might at the job. So you can really screw with people too when you do this. And I've suggested this to a number of clients. I've never had one do it. But if you're tracking your competitors and you've got their cookies and you know who they are when they come to your website, you can show them anything you want. If they come to your store, you can show them goofy prices. You can turn your corporate website into a recruiting website, right? To recruit from your competitors. I would love to see somebody do that sometime. Okay, so that's my talk. Thanks for coming. If you have questions, we've got a little bit of time now. We've got 5 minutes. Otherwise, I'm doing a book signing at the No Starch booth, and I'll be there at noon. That'd be a good time just to chat about whatever. So thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.